This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
Well, I'll just confess, first of all, that this is an interesting one to give, because I got this email saying, ask if I would talk on this, and I looked at it, and it said, financial stewardship and missions doesn't really matter. And I thought, well, I can answer that in one word. And they want me to talk 40 minutes on it, so. And I look back here and I see Mark Payne back here, and I think it has to be yes, you know, since he does our books. But what I'd like to do is walk through a little of maybe a story to start with and just some basic principles, and then I'd like to open up for discussion. There's a lot of wealth sitting here in the room, and maybe listen to some of you and your experience. Most of you have probably read about Greg Mortensen. In 1993, he was in Pakistan and ended up climbing or trying to climb K2, the world's second highest mountain. He failed to reach the summit, but according to him, on his way back down, he ended up in a Pakistani village, took a wrong end, ended up in this remote village and lived there for a while. And these people, they were a very strong Muslim community, and they nursed him back to health. And as he was there, he noticed that in the streets, the children were using sticks and a piece of paper on the dirt there, and they were just drawing and adding up sums and doing things in the dirt, and it just bothered him as he watched that, just the disparity of what he was used to in the United States. So when he got back, he started to tell a few people, and he went back again and to Pakistan and helped these people. He ended up writing a book, and most of you have probably seen this book, Three Cups of Tea. He told of being kidnapped by the Taliban. He started an organization called Central Asia Institute, and some of you have probably read about that, but that brought in millions of dollars. And there was something about the message of taking education into extreme Muslim setting and teaching people instead of bombing them that really resounded with Americans. A lot of businessmen got on board. A lot of large donors connected with the mission. Some of them went over even to investigate and make sure that schools were being built, and they were. They saw a wonderful result. He came back and just told and showed pictures, but then suddenly in 2001, CBS on 60 Minutes gave a presentation, and they said that he'd spent $4.6 million promoting that book. In other words, the money that was going into these schools, he was actually diverting and taking that money and using it to promote his own little program. There were other things come out of that. Some of the things didn't actually occur. In fact, he never had actually been captured by the Taliban. People that he said in the book had treated him very roughly, actually it didn't happen either. He stretched a lot of stories. Some schools were never built. Some were abandoned, being used for other things. He didn't expose that to the public. He just kept on bringing the millions in. Probably the worst thing, though, is he charged Central Asia Institute for a private jet, and he flew around promoting his book with this jet, and CBS said that only 41% of the dollars coming in were actually going to these schools. Well, one of the donors wrote a book called Three Cups of Deceit, and he had put $75,000 into this, and he was pretty hot about the whole thing. Now, all that has passed now, and supposedly they've straightened everything out, but you know, to this day, people still have a distaste for that whole thing. Even though there's a new board and they say they're doing lots of things right, there's a lack of confidence that lingers. And I thought about this. I think I put Will Rogers on this. I think he's the one that said this. You will never get a second chance to make a first impression. And that's true, especially in organizations. If you're not honest all the way through with everything, I want to talk about the difficulty in that in nonprofits. But if you don't make that a integrity, an integral part of your organization, it's very hard to back up. So I'm going to just look at a few areas. First of all, integrity, transparency, and accountability. Think about integrity as just operating legally and ethically. Is there handouts for this? There should have been some handouts. Transparency, just nothing's hid. Everything's open before donors and public. Critical data is always made available to people. And then accountability. or a structure to ensure that those goals are actually being met. And there's no one within any organization that should be unaccountable. It doesn't matter if you're the founder of it. You should always be accountable. One time years ago, I was first getting started, starting the SALT program, and I rode around one day with an Amishman, and probably some of you would know who he is. I can't remember his name now. He was on the Haiti benefit auction board, and I was his driver for the day. I was just trying to learn, so I just drove him around from job to job and just tried to learn. I was just getting started. And he told me, he said, one of the things that we look for in the Haiti benefit auction, maybe some of you are involved in that, I don't know, but he said, one of the things we look for is we really shy away from family-run organizations. He said, it just seems like if the father's there and all of his boys are on the board, that sooner or later we're going to find a problem with that. And really what he was saying was it wasn't structured properly. There wasn't proper accountability in that. So think of this as a three-legged stool. Accountability, integrity, and transparency. Absolutely essential. And again, once you start fudging on any of these, it's difficult to recover. Paul told the church at Corinth this. He was talking about sending help to Jerusalem, but he said, avoiding this, that no man should blame us in this abundance, which is administered by us, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. He's talking here about sending two people, making sure that two people are going and delivering this money that's been raised. But notice the commitment here to integrity, transparency, and accountability in the early church. The Amplified says this, for we take thought beforehand and aim to be honest and absolutely above suspicion, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Open regarding fundraising and overhead costs. This is an interesting one. You know, in the SALT program that I work with, it's hard sometimes to know what overhead is. Because sometimes teaching, which to me is the primary thing we do in the SALT program, can be called overhead, but really it's an essential, integral part of that program. So if you remove that, then you really have lost a lot. So it's hard to know how to implement that sometimes as far as being open about it. It's also easy, I think, to justify fundraising. And maybe we'll get into this a little more later. I think some of you have some stories even on this. But it's easy to think that techniques, as long as they bring in money from a majority, are okay. But sometimes those can backfire. Spending too much money, being too visible out there in sharing information and spending on that. Willingness to admit failure. This is a tough one for organizations. But I want to ask you, and I can see several organizations that are represented here, but think about this. How open are you to telling when you made a mistake? You know, sometimes I look at newsletters, and they remind me of Christmas letters. You know, you get Christmas letters from families, and there's a picture of the family, and everybody's smiling. It's just wonderful. And you read this thing about their last year, and, well, everything was good. I mean, it's such a wonderful year, on and on and on. And I start to get suspicious about two-thirds through. I mean, was their year really like that? Really, I mean, there was no problems. In fact, I read one a while back, and they told about a problem they had, and even that turned out good. You know, in the end, they'd spun the whole thing. And sometimes newsletters, I get that same sense from them that, okay, really? I mean, I've been out in the field enough to know that I could write a newsletter on mistakes, you know, just mistakes I've made. But how honest are we about making mistakes? There's a gathering in Washington, D.C., I think it's every 2 years, called Fail Fair. Maybe some of you have read about it, but it's an organization that's went about, that they've asked organizations to come, but if you're going to come, you have to be willing to share some mistakes you've made. You have to be willing to open up and tell the mistakes. And their theory is that we learn from mistakes, so why don't we talk about it more? Why don't we go ahead and share what's going on? And I've wondered about that. Should we do more of that? Should we, within our organization, and even sometimes to the public, go ahead and be open about the fact that we tried this, but it just didn't work. We learned this from it, and now we're going to do this. Clear and quantifiable goals. Someone else said this over these meetings, that no one mission can do everything. And I've wondered before, can you name what you're not doing? In other words, are you specifically choosing not to go down some roads? Have you narrowed in? And do you know exactly what you're doing? Are you sticking with that? Does everyone in the organization know what your real goals are? Your core values. Someone talked about that, about writing those down. I think that's so essential. We did that a while back. That was so valuable to just start writing down and honing in on what are our core values? What are we doing? What are we not doing? What about the organizations you support? Do you know what they're doing? If you're writing checks to someone, do you know what it is actually they're doing? Consistent and standardized record keeping. There's some of you could talk on this for a long time here in the room. I've noticed this. I'll just say this honestly. Visionaries that start programs are usually not record keepers. And that's me. You know, I'm more of a visionary. I can picture what should happen out there, but I've learned pretty quick that I better get somebody else to take care of. I just don't enjoy all the data entry. That's not my thing. And I think it's extremely important. I'd like to hear maybe later more from some of you on that. But we need someone to come alongside a visionary to hold him accountable. Let's think a little about the inherent challenge. Milton Friedman wrote a book called Free to Choose. In that book, he talked about four ways to spend money. And I want to put this up here just to think about it a little bit. On one end of this continuum, there's great caution and concern. And over here, there's little concern or caution. And when we spend our own money on ourselves, we tend, and these are all tendencies, we tend to be very, very careful how we spend that money. We want to make sure we get the most for the money. We want the best product. We're very, very cautious. That tends to be our tendency. If I'm buying a car for myself, I look at the price and the car. I want both to be right. But if you're spending your own money for someone else, there's a little less of that tendency. Maybe you're buying a birthday present for someone else. But in that case, we tend to not be as concerned about the content, but we're still concerned about the price because we're fairly self-centered people. But if you're spending someone else's money for yourself, then you're going to enjoy it. In other words, maybe it's a gift card. You get a gift card from somebody, and I've noticed this. My wife would be more this way than I am. If you get the gift card, it's like she wants to max it. She can't wait to spend the thing to start with. I've tried to persuade her. It's just another asset in your wallet. But to her, it needs to be, we need to do something with it. We need to get moving here. And I'm sure that's why the whole thing is promoted. But finally, someone else's money for someone else. Very little concern about the cost and very little concern about the content or the quality of that thing. Too often, laziness sets in. Now, what I've just described in this last one is government. That's how it is. The government, there's not a lot of concern, but it also can be nonprofit because you're dealing with someone else's money, and it's very easy to get lax with that and just get a little free with that, especially if there's plenty of it. Now, every business has a culture, and this tends to develop certain cultures. We'll talk later how to avoid that, but it does tend to develop a certain culture. Jack Welch once said, culture drives great results, but it can also drive poor results if we don't work at that culture, especially in a nonprofit. There's something I've thought about different times in a nonprofit, and I made the swap here in 2009. I was involved in business, and I was self-employed, had a couple businesses going, and I sold both of those in 2009 and went to work at Christian Aid Ministries. And I noticed immediately there's a change. Now, Christian Aid's a good organization. I love working there, good people. But there's a difference when people are working with for money and profit and when you're in a nonprofit. And I've been challenged by that. In fact, we've had a lot of discussions on that. You know, in business, things need to happen quickly. That's just how it is. There's competition there. There's pressure. And so that tends to fit my personality anyway. I like to get things done and get moving. In a nonprofit, over time, it's easy to slow that whole thing down. Just not worry about it too much. Committee gets together and talks about this. Maybe not that much happens. It's not that big of a deal. And if you're not careful, a nonprofit can move in an opposite direction to inefficiency. That happens very easily. I think the lesson out of that, though, is this. It's very important in a nonprofit to develop and keep exhorting each other to a God consciousness. And we'll get to that in just a minute. We need to keep reminding ourselves that we are not the owner. We're actually responsible for how we deal with what's been given to us. So to whom is a mission accountable? Is it the donor or is it the owner? In other words, the primary responsibility, when you have money coming in, who is the responsibility to? And I think we need to think about this often. I really think it's to both. But ultimately, we're going to give an account to the Lord. And the Bible tells us who the owner is. Psalm 50, "For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon 1,000 hills. I know all the fowls of the mountains, and the beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell thee. For the world is mine and the fullness thereof." We get caught up sometimes in pleasing donors. We need those donors. Sometimes we forget who the real owner actually is. That's true on an individual level, but it's true in nonprofits as well. Sometimes the golden rule prevails, that whoever has the gold makes the rules. But what happens if those who are writing the checks don't have a good picture of what's going on out in the field? If they start pulling the strings and trying to make things happen out in the field? What if donors have secret motives in giving? I think it's easy sometimes to lose sight of the responsibility we have to the Lord, but ultimately we're going to give an account to the owner. We need to keep coming back to this, that we're going to stand before God not as mission administrators, but as stewards of His goods. And people are entrusting that into our care when they write out a check. I was in a country, it's been several years ago now, and I want to tell a story just to illustrate a little of the tension that can exist. It was a country where there was a 7 or 8 churches. Each of these churches had a pastor. Each of these pastors had been supported for quite a while. And these pastors had become lazier and lazier and lazier. And this mission board saw this happening. And this went on from the time that mission started until I arrived. It was about 20-some years this had been going on. It gradually built a culture of laziness. Now, picture for a little bit the dilemma this board was in. On the one hand, they knew this was occurring. They knew these pastors were getting lazier and lazier. And so they tried to talk these pastors into getting a job, and they'd try different things, but the pastors weren't interested. Because the pastors knew this. They knew that they had the key to 20 years of work for this mission. And on the other side of this board was donors who've been writing checks for 20 years. And these pastors, I think maybe subconsciously even knew, there was no way this board could fire them. Because if the whole congregation disintegrated, the work of 20 years was gone, so there's a tension developed here. The board's caught in the middle. So the board came, and I met them there in this country, and they wanted me to fix this thing, and one of them suggested maybe a 3-day seminar would take care of it. I said, there's no way a 3-day seminar is going to take care of this. You've got 20 years here of teaching these men something. And they said, well, we can't just stop, because they were afraid at that point the churches would fall apart, which told a little more about how strong these churches were to start with. But those are the kind of dilemmas we get in, was the board had a hard time making hard decisions because they had a group of donors that had been putting money in for a long time. But what would have happened if over the years, first of all, they would have taken a more sustainable path, but also they could have talked to donors about this and being open about this. And I think they could have relieved a lot of pressure. They're still working on that situation. It's getting a little better. But those are the dilemmas we get ourselves into, I think, sometimes partly by not being open and partly by not having a more sustainable vision. Fundraising questions and challenges. How aggressively should missions pursue money? You know, money is needed. We have to have it in many of our programs. But sometimes fundraising can become a barometer of success, where how much money you go through, that tells a little bit about what's happening. But you know, other organizations don't do that. For-profit organizations don't do that. When I was operating a construction company, we didn't measure by success by how much lumber went through. We didn't do that. It was by how much actually happened. And sometimes I think we need to be holding our organization is more accountable to what's actually happening out in the field, what's going on there, and ask some questions. But how aggressively should missions pursue it? Are you giving as much thought to moving people as moving dollars? And I think these are some questions that we need to be asking ourselves. Are there methods that Jesus would not use? I want to read just a passage here that he said. I want you to think about efforts at raising money. Take heed that ye do not your alms before men to be seen of them. Otherwise ye have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and the streets, they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have the reward. But when thou doest alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth, that thine alms may be in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret himself shall reward thee openly. I want to ask, like just a little brief discussion here, any thoughts on methods of fundraising that do not fit this passage? Explain that. I'm not very familiar with
it. The benefit option, something sold for a price, and then they say, well, you sell it again.
Oh, I see. So everyone knows who it was that... Yeah, very good. Anybody else? Okay. What about sharing needs versus pressured appeals? Notice this. George Mueller said, "It is not enough to obtain means for the work of God, but that these means should be obtained in God's way. To ask unbelievers for means is not God's way. To press even believers to give is not God's way. But the duty and the privilege of being allowed to contribute to the work of God should be pointed out, and this should be followed up with earnest prayer, believing prayer, will result in the desired end." Now, I just copied this off. Is that correct? Is it wrong to ask unbelievers for money? That's just George Mueller's opinion. Any thoughts on that? I personally probably wouldn't agree with that. I would probably take if an unbeliever wants to put money into something, I would probably take it. But anyway, I was intrigued with that thought. Anybody agree with that? You would agree? Yeah. I just hadn't thought much about that, about not asking an unbeliever for help. John Stolzfus said one time that there was a man there, he doesn't know who he was, but the girls kept saying he would pull in a yellow pickup and walk up and put some money in the cam, just give him random money and go back and drive off. Didn't say anything. They had no idea who he was, and he kept asking them to get a picture. He wanted to see this fellow. He just kept doing this, just stop in. It was always an odd amount of money. Probably had something to do with the prayer he'd made, or, you know, I don't know. But he wasn't from an Anabaptist background at all, and it was kind of interesting to him. Should some donations be rejected? In other words, is there a time to say no to a donation? I'd like to hear a little bit. There's several organizations here. Are there times when you have just said no? Okay. Legal requirements. What else? Any other reason something should be? Yeah, very good. What about where the donor is getting a particular thing, or you know, I talked about whoever has the gold makes the rules. What happens when he's asking you to use it in a certain way that you're not sure that's really helpful out in the field, but you don't really want to lose the money either? What do you do in those situations? Any thoughts on that? I'll give you an example of one. I was on a mission one time. Again, I tend to get into these missions or having trouble probably. But in this situation, they had a donor that kept giving them vehicles. And these vehicles became a source of conflict in the field. In other words, in this setting, the people all walked everywhere when they arrived. And now these vehicles started arriving, and so they used them to pick people up and carry them to church and whatever, and more vehicles came. And so after a while, no one was walking anymore in this community. They were all beginning. In fact, they had a route picked that ran around, and everybody was picked up at a certain time. And there was frustration if the thing was late, and there got to be all these dilemmas. And frankly, there was several hundred thousand dollars of vehicles in this mission, but they hadn't wanted to say no because they didn't want it to hurt this donor that really wanted to give these vehicles. That's what I'm thinking about. Are there times like that? Can you think of illustrations even in your own missions where you've been asked to accept something that really might compromise what you're after? In this setting, they did not need those vehicles. But this man who was coming, he thought they did. He shouldn't be walking that far. I mean, these poor folks, you know. But the people living there, walking was a part of life until these vehicles arrived, and now suddenly it was a necessity. But can you think of situations like that where it really changes the vision and compromises your vision for being there? And that's why I wanted to bring this up. I think it's good to think about in an organization is is, are we trying just to please donors out there and do what they want, or do I actually care about the people we're serving out there? And that can be tough, because sometimes we have to make hard choices and not have enough money even to stay honest to what we're trying to do out there in the field.
Well, if we were on the mission field and everything like that, that would be a disaster.
Seen it happen too with, I've been in places where, you know, an American comes over and they see a need for a backhoe. Well, they don't need a backhoe there. They've got all these men sitting around doing nothing. But it's hard to persuade an American to back off with that money. Or a tractor and disc. I had situations where they come in, they write out a check right now for $50,000 to get this man a tractor, and that would ruin the whole economy and the whole area there. But sometimes, in fact, we've taken tours, and it's I'm not sure yet if it's a good idea, because we bring all these ideas in, and it's, we just say no all the time, and all that happens is the people go home thinking you're hard to get along with. Okay, I want to think about newsletters a little bit and stewarding information. There's tremendous power in newsletters and in stories. But I guess the burden of what I have is as a mission, you're doing more than just raising money. And many times you're providing a window and a global perspective by how you write newsletters. And what you're really doing is you're telling the world, or you're telling these your donor, how the world works in that setting. Think about mixing honesty with emotional stories. It's been said that statistics don't lie, but liars use statistics. And you can use statistics to say things in a certain way. I'll give you an example. How often do you get a newsletter that tells you that obesity is a bigger problem than starvation in our world? That's a true fact. But we don't hear that very much, because that does not bring dollars in. Over time, we can shift viewpoints. I forget who it was. Someone just sent me a link to a website where they ask you a bunch of questions just to see how much you understood about global poverty. And the results had been horrendous. I mean, most of us have a twisted view. A lot of that's due to newsletters. Newsletters develop mindsets. I think about this. And we've dealt with it some with the SALT program. When you get a newsletter once a month that shows that someone received a box of food and everything's okay now, or that they received a goat and now they lived happily ever after. Now, we tell these stories, and it's so far from reality sometimes. The fact is that chronic poverty takes a lot of time to move someone. It doesn't happen with one weekend or one seminar or whatever. But in our desire to get funding from people, we can stretch truth very easily without even realizing it. They are glad. We can put statements in of what they actually said. They said, thank you, it's changed my life and whatever. But what about honesty and all that? Over time, can we develop mindsets that really are not accurate? I want to suggest that honesty and transparency develops patient donors. And chronic poverty especially requires patient donors, someone who's willing to keep walking with you. But to do that, you're going to have to use a newsletter to do more than just get funds from people, but also to share and explain and do some teaching even, what works and what doesn't. 1 Corinthians 4:2, moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. Maybe that's the answer to the question I was supposed to answer. I want to make this comment, too, with regard to Anabaptist principles. I think it's easy, and maybe some of you could speak to this later, but it's easy to shift our vision away from the desires of the people. In other words, I think most of our donors are looking for people willing to stick with conservative Anabaptist doctrine, teaching, and methods. And when you start shifting away from that, I think we end up losing a lot of donors. I really do. I think we need to stay with, and I'd like to hear more, when you start moving into Protestant methods, many times over time donations will drop. They won't right at first. In fact, I think they might increase at first. But I think over time they will drop. I want to say one more thing with regard to those giving. I talk to a lot of people who talk about they just give to to wherever the need is most, let somebody else figure it out. But I wonder sometimes if we shouldn't be giving more thought and prayer to where donations are going. And think about that. Be specific about it. Because many times donations drive an organization one way or another. And if you're careful and prayerful, you can help do that. Help steer organizations in the right direction. Yeah, I just jotted down a few notes for discussion here. I talked about transparency about mistakes. I'd like to hear a little discussion on that. How transparent should we be with mistakes? I think if some of us told all the mistakes, we probably wouldn't get any more money. So how much do you just fill it up with mistakes, or never, or a little now and then? Anybody have anything they want to say on that? Would funding decrease if failure were shared? Think about that in your own ministry. Or if you suddenly, with your donor base, started to just put a little failure out there, have you, like Richie said, built such high expectations that they'd be shocked? Maybe humility is part of this, of having humility even in our newsletters, and just admit that we're still learning here, we're still trying. I read or heard a while back about someone who contacted the head of an organization and wanted a list of mistakes that they had made. He said he couldn't think of any. And that troubled me a little bit, you know, because especially in chronic poverty, if you can't think of any, you're not being very observant, because we all do. It's examples of using newsletters to educate. That was my last note. Anybody have ways they've used their newsletter to help educate individuals, their donor base? I'm thinking about just giving your donors a realistic global perspective. Any ideas on that? I think we'd all like to do that more, but it'd be nice to learn from others. I can just tell we've talked a little in the SALT. We have a SALT newsletter of just each time or occasionally putting a little educational, just a little bit in there to just teach. It has nothing to do with anything we're doing in the field, just a little teaching in there to help build a little bit of knowledge in those writing the checks.
Knowledge of what?
Knowledge of what actually works out in the field and what doesn't. Yeah. In our case, dependency, sustainability is usually what we're working on, and chronic poverty.
Information.
That's right. Yeah, but more than just right now writing a check, long-term education, to write some teaching. Well, okay, Richie, you had a couple things. We got just a couple minutes. Did you have something you wanted to share with regard to fundraising? So watch your personal spending and listen to your constituency base. That's interesting. It makes perfect sense to look at the lives of the people who are making the decisions. I hadn't put that together before. Very good. Okay, well, we are out of time. Thank you all for contributing and helping out. Lord bless you and your organizations and your writing checks.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.